Well, hello everyone. It is that time again where I read from Andre Siegfried's The Character of Peoples. It's his final chapter. I have called the video, Is Western Civilization Doomed by Its Own Success? The actual chapter heading is Definition and Destiny of Western Civilization. Now remember, Siegfried was writing in 1952. Just before we get going here, I'll remind people, pick up the Trivium to level up your writing skills, your logic skills, your rhetoric skills today. There's a lot of great persuasion material in the rhetoric section. Or pick up Foundations of Shakespeare, or Foundations of Politics, or Foundations of Economics, or Entrepreneurship, or any of the other great courses that are available at the academic agency. Now, let us waste no further time. This is going to be the last chapter from this. He says, from the six preceding sketches, certain traits have emerged which are common to and characteristic of our civilization. They explain its brilliant success, but they also permit us to conceive of the possibility of its decline, or at least of its coming transformation. For a long time, it was possible to combine in the same association of ideas Europe, the white race, or at least the most important section of the white race, and Western civilization. That continued until the Age of Great Discoveries, the old continent remaining up to then the whole of the West. But when white men spread all over the world, exploring, conquering, and exploiting, Europe, whilst remaining their chief domicile, ceased to be their only domain, and a Western civilization developed which extended geographically beyond its original cradle. North America finally became such an essential part of the system that one might well ask whether it was not destined to become its centre, whilst at the same time a whole Euro-Asiatic zone escaped its influence altogether. With its center of gravity adrift and out of control, it is doubtful whether the West can long retain the traditional characteristics which once made up its personality. The sources of Western civilization are remote and varied. It seems to me that Western civilization rests on three things. Number one, knowledge. Number two, man. And number three, technique. Under its modern form, the Industrial Revolution. From the standpoint of knowledge, it is from Greece that we draw our methods of thought and reasoning. The critical spirit, the habit of observation, and the unprejudiced approach to problems represent the essential heritage the Greeks have handed to us. From ancient times, they conceived of the independence of human intelligence, freed from all magic, prophecies and irrational things, and even from religion itself. To some extent, they may be said to have secularized the sphere of knowledge. It is from them that we learn the art of methodical reasoning and the art of demonstrating by arguments before which intelligence could do nothing but yield. The gods themselves had to obey the exigencies of logic. And here we can see the first line of demarcation will reveal itself between the East and the West. It is, to be noted, a demarcation line of the spirit. In literature and science, already highly developed in Syria and in Egypt, the Easterner commands, scolds, supplicates, prophesies, and when he observes, he relates, enumerates, compiles, and collects. The Greek also observed phenomenon, but then he sought to develop general laws based on his observations and to discover the intelligible reason of things. The Egyptians were quite remarkable surveyors, but Euclid was a geometrician. Between these two methods, there is a difference. Less of degree than of kind, and the latter method represented a decisive step in human development, with which even the most sophisticated Asiatic civilizations, that of China, for example, have not caught up even now. Today, wherever men observe, reason, and think as the Greeks did, they are in the West. It is an intellectual climate which is immediately recognizable. This method of reasoning presupposes the idea of an individual capable of controlling himself. The reasoning man is a free man, subject only to laws which he imposes on himself or which he accepts, whence the greatest interest he takes in public affairs, which he regards as his affairs. Having a right to respect for his human dignity and his critical liberty, his law gives him the necessary guarantees. When the Greeks fought against the Persians, it was as free men, conscious of being free men, as against subjects of a master, an amorphous mass without spiritual cohesion. From the political standpoint, our conception of the individual was born there. Daughter of the Greek city-state, our democracy, inseparable from liberalism, rests on the idea of laws freely admitted and not imposed, in direct contrast to the whims of the despot. The battlefield of Marathon is one of those high symbolic places which no man of the West should visit without emotion. The Hellenistic logos embraces an innate sense of relations and proportions. The East knows the enormous, the colossal, and delights in it. The Greek preferred the harmony, which comes from due measure. Whoever is aware of the relation of things amongst themselves becomes capable of suiting his aims to the means at his disposal for attaining them. Thus he acquires a rule of conduct, which is not in itself a morality, but which is, in that which concerns him, practically nevertheless a morality. In fully accepting this way of looking at things, or rather doing things, the West has acquired the specific instrument of its power, that which distinguishes the white race from all the others, its efficiency. When serious matters are at stake, or matters which it chooses to consider as serious, the West applies the rational Greek method without reservation and without qualms, even against religion itself, though it may bow to it from deference. Although Greece had her full share of the irrational, she had set aside a whole province of man's life in which reason developed independently without regard to anything outside it. The liberation was not complete in the social sphere, but it was fully so in questions of investigation, science, and reasoning. We in the West have adopted that fundamental distinction which exists neither in Asia nor in Islam, so that today the old frontier between Greece, the mother of the West, and the East still exists, an impressive circumstance, almost in the same place. The delimitation is not only between God and Caesar, but between God and Minerva, the goddess of wisdom, or perhaps we should say today, between God and his most dangerous present-day rival, the goddess of efficiency. In course of time, Greek civilization became sterile Byzantium, which perpetuated it almost down to our own day, lost its original inspiration. With only the tradition of Greek thought, the West would have not become what it is, and beyond doubt another graft was necessary. It is here that the Jewish contribution, and then that of the Bible, operates. The Jews developed the conception of a personal God and of man's relation to him. It was a passionate monotheism, in strong contrast with the sceptical polytheism of the Greeks. The Greek gods, so full of human failings, so absolutely subject to the laws of time and logic, so little divine in short, are no more than a charming and fantastic fiction in our eyes. But our own God has remained, particularly for Protestantism, the God of Abraham. It was the Patriarch of Ur who gave us our idea of God truly almighty, with an omnipotence surpassing all laws, and for some, all morality. He is a jealous and exclusive God, with whom the believer, by faith, concludes a sort of pact. It is no longer a question of intellect or reason, but of mystique, for who would undertake to justify the sacrifice of Isaac by reason? The ancient Bedouin of Ur is at the source of a way of feeling which is perpetuated today even amongst millions of Westerners. And the fact that both Jews and Mohammedans recognize him as a prophet does nothing to diminish the great place he holds in our religious life. During my visits to Jerusalem, my first thought was always of Golgotha, but the legendary rock preserved in the Mosque of Omar appeared to me afterwards no less important as evidence of our spiritual origins. The source is Asiatic, but let us specify that it is Western Asia, because Central Asia has conceived only atheistic religions in which man himself has become God. With Abraham, a monotheistic zone begins, to which our Western world is deeply attached. Distinct from India and China in the East, and separated from the animism and polytheism of Africa by our frontiers, it embraces essentially the Jews, the Mohammedans, and the Christians. For we must also place ourselves in the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is also from Jewish tradition through Christianity that our conception of the individual considered as a moral unit has come. The moral law, a categoric commandment, derives not from reason but from a higher authority, different in its essence, and the change brought about by Jesus Christ in de-Judaizing it does not alter its fundamental character. The enormous role played by Christianity in the development of the Western world, in which it constitutes perhaps the main unit, underlines the originality of this conception of the human being, seen not as an individual intelligence, but as a spiritual unit. The Greek developed the idea of order. The Jew, and after him the Christian, occupied himself with the idea of justice. But order is a rule, and justice is a passion. Pressure, temperature, and tension vary from place to place. The jealous and passionate feeling for what is due injustice, possibly neglected, scoffed at, and trodden underfoot by the social authority, derives from a spirit of protest, which is, properly speaking, revolutionary. A mystical breath, pregnant with storms, arising in ancient Judea, has thus swept through the centuries and continues to shake the ground under our feet. To the extent to which such a ferment works in us, we are less Orphean or Apollonian than Hebraic. I am inclined to believe that this influence is felt more amongst Protestants than Catholics, and more amongst Protestant Anglo-Saxons than anywhere else. The Bible is in fact traditionally the basic reading of the Protestant, and not only the New Testament, but also the Old. The interpretation of this verse or that phrase from Genesis, the Psalms or the Prophets, is at the origin of more than one American Protestant sect. And in this kind of way, a kind of Eastern presence insinuates itself into the very heart of the extreme West. From the daily reading of the scriptures, a sort of biblical culture has been born in the English-speaking countries. It is more popular than aristocratic and charged with poetry, colour, oratorical lyricism, and human hopes. It is a strange thing that Jewish dynamism, translated into social protest, should find itself again even in the most forbidding technique, which it seems, as in the case of Karl Marx, to inflame with its passion. In taking up these old Eastern notions, the West has transformed them to the point at which they contradict their original significance. The evangelical conception of the dignity of the most humble, developed in the 17th century into an affirmation of political equality. The cry of the prophet, bitterly demanding justice, is at the source of our modern social mystique. Evangelical selflessness paradoxically becomes a source of efficiency. The aim to save one's soul, but the habit of resisting temptation and the aestheticism of self-control develop into an instrument of worldly success. There is a disconcerting ambiguity here, because spiritual inspiration leads to material achievement. In the circumstances, one might even wonder whether the mysticism of Abraham is not the remote source of our modern imperialism, because did not God himself promise to compensate the patriarch with the gift of earthly power? In accepting this interpretation, the West has made a transposition, which is perhaps treason from the standpoint of spiritual values. Neither the Greeks nor the Jews made any attempt to abstract the rule, either from the principle or the passion. It is to Rome that we owe our ideas of order and our legal structure. There was no authentic West in the old continent except for the Roman limes. Ancient Asia certainly proved able to introduce the institution of the state, but in a despotic form only. The Greek city-states created democracy, but without finding the golden mean between anarchy and tyranny. Europe has always harbored a longing for Pax Romana, for a universal order based on a grand administration uniting the whole of civilization under the same laws. In such a system, the law guarantees and regulates property, and thus assures the civic independence of the individual. The conception of man, which arose in the Eastern Mediterranean, thereby received a juridical expression which guaranteed its existence. It was in the same way that in its Catholic phase, Rome disciplined and canonized the original gospel stream, freeing it from its Jewish source. Thus, a threefold tradition survived through the Middle Ages into modern times: that of Greece, the synonym for intellectual liberty; that of the Bible, with its Jewish facets, the symbol of human idealism; and that of Rome, the bringer of civic order. It was from all three sources, in turn, that the Renaissance in the 13th century, the century of light, was to draw its sustenance. The West could then be regarded as complete, as achieved, and in a sense, perhaps the best sense, it was so in fact. But there was still one factor lacking to make it what it is today, to perfect it, to throw it off its balance, a final phase, that of industrialization. It was the adoption of a new technique, the technique of the mechanical age, which provided the West with the decisive instrument of its present power. The Industrial Revolution took place in Western Europe in the 18th century, but it was in the 17th century that scientists and philosophers perfected the methods which really opened up new paths to Western humanity. We must first draw a distinction here between science and technique. The Greeks had already developed the rules of scientific observation and, up to a point, of scientific experimentation. They were familiar with the idea of natural law to such an extent that in this respect the moderns were not innovators. But with a few exceptions, the ancients were content to confine themselves to the sphere of theory. They were more anxious to think over things, a more noble function from their standpoint, than to seek after material progress. They lived in the mild climate of the Mediterranean, which did nothing to make the preoccupations of everyday life an imperative matter. Archimedes even apologized for his ingenious inventions. Within a civilization whose center was shifted to the northwest of Europe, it became imperative for man to fight against cold, damp, and the vagaries of the climate in general. He was compelled by necessity to turn his attention to the problem of making his daily existence more agreeable. In these conditions, science began to go beyond mere contemplation, and technique prepared to go beyond science. Doubtless, where the scientists and thinkers were concerned, the urge to know remained the dominant impulse. But science no longer dissociated itself from the application of its discoveries. Incidentally, it was the man's thought which furnished him with the means. Baconian experimentalism is the source of modern efficiency, whilst Cartesianism potentially contained American rationalization. It was these 17th century masters of thought, the successors of the ancient Greeks, who by methods they perfected made possible the tremendous industrial expansion of the 19th and 20th centuries. Mechanism, as practiced in the West, would not have been possible without science and without Greek reasoning, something which the East does not possess today any more than it did yesterday. However, this mechanism is above all a technique. It is the harnessing of factors of nature in the service of man, whereby the latter's power is immeasurably increased. The tool, the instrument of the Neolithic age, was put into operation only by the muscular energy of man, which was, of course, strictly limited. The machine, on the other hand, has no longer any relation with the physical strength of man, and its productive possibilities are unlimited, so much so that to us nothing any longer seems impossible in this respect. An entirely new form of social life has arisen as a consequence of this fact, because science as harnessed in the service of industry is a very different thing from science as objective curiosity. It is transformed into a discipline applied to fact in order to bend them to the requirements of man. The dominant factor is now the will of power, the impatience to open up and exploit the whole world. Man is master of his actions, but he is no longer master of himself. He is carried away by a sort of indisciplined romanticism. To quote Barrès again, it is method in the service of passion. It is, in short, not a distinct period of history, but a new age in the life of humanity. After the Neolithic, or the Tool Age, follows the age of the machine. It goes parallel with the policy of ruthless and frantic exploitation of natural resources of the earth, without the least thought for the future. And this is in part the explanation of that impression of sudden and immeasurable riches conveyed by a civilization which is wasting its substance. For a century and a half, the West possessed a monopoly of science and of mechanized industry, but as a result, its power became irresistible. The balance which existed between Europe and Asia in the 17th century was upset, and the latter, discovering tardily that Western technique was synonymous with political domination, was forced to assimilate it, less from admiration than from a desire to defend itself. Today, all continents, all countries, all peoples clamour after the machine. But it is one thing to use a machine once it is made, and quite another to invent it or to replace it. And it is this circumstance which forms the basis, still solid despite everything, on which Western superiority rests. Outwardly, it is a question of technical progress. But in reality, the success of the West depends on factors every bit as complex as the remote and varied sources from which it stems. It is at this point that we can see the possibility of a crisis on the horizon of our civilization. Its technique derives essentially from its culture, and in denying its culture or in leaning too far towards the technical side, it would risk compromising the very sources of its own validity. Western civilization developed in a certain geographic environment. Originally, it was the Mediterranean, and more particularly of the Eastern Mediterranean. By comparison with the Asiatic continental mass, Greek life was maritime, articulated, and diverse. Rome, whose structure was less diverse, still remained Mediterranean. Subsequently, it was in Central and Northwest Europe that the industrial system developed, which characterizes the modern West. Although today the center of technological progress tends to shift to the new world, it is still in the old that we must look for its primary impulse. Thus, geographical circumstances easily recognizable are at the origin of our civilization. First of all, and particularly in the Mediterranean, there was a geographical environment, so to speak, of human proportions, in which nature did not overwhelm man and did not appear disproportionate in relation to him and his activities. Man is the measure of all things, proclaimed Protagoras, the Greek sophist. It is a characteristic axiom, and Paul Valery has called it essentially Mediterranean, but one could equally say that it was essentially European. In our old continent, at least where it really is itself, one has the impression that man is adapted to nature. The same is true of the climate, temperature, temperate and oceanic and never aggressively continental. It is a climate of long semi-seasons. It makes for neither overstimulation nor for deep depression. On the contrary, it lends itself to measured effort with results that can be calculated in advance. In such an environment, a proper relation exists between the human being and the natural surroundings in which he lives, and Europe is unquestionably the only continent in which this is true. The consequences are obvious. The possibility of fitting the effort to the aim pursued is productive of morality, or at least of a certain reasonable sense of conduct, including an exact idea of time and space. Where the geographical structure is formidable, where the climate runs to extremes, as in the case in Africa, Asia, and America, this sort of moral balance of conduct does not develop so fully. Labour there is either too easy or too difficult, and there is no established relation between the effort exerted and the result obtained. Hence the spirit of speculation which claims to reap without waiting, or the ignorance of the tiller of the soil who thinks he can take anything he likes out of it without ever exhausting it. The European peasant is, on the other hand, very well aware that man's powers in this respect are limited, and that a certain quantity of production corresponds necessary to a certain amount of effort. It may be that war has compromised this economic morality even with us, but when we compare our actions and our ways of production with those of other races, even with those of non-European whites, we cannot but recognize that Europe has developed a labor morale which is one of the principal factors of its success. Not all white men are associated with Western civilization, and those in the East have remained unwilling to join it. Nevertheless, although Western civilization is the result of a certain environment, it is also the work of a race, the white race, and the white race alone made Western civilization. The distance which separates them from the black or the red-skinned man is enormous, and although the yellow-skinned man, or the yellow-skinned men, have shown themselves capable of a comparable efficiency, they suffer technically from 3 centuries of backwardness. In these conditions, our civilization corresponds to a geographical sphere whose limits it is interesting to define. In the days of antiquity, the East was distinct from that which was not called the West, from that Greek world which was to devise a new way of thought. The Aegean Sea, with the Greek cities on the Asiatic coast, corresponded to a civilization which was different from that of the Persians, which was Eastern. When, in the days of Alexander, Hellenism extended as far as India, it seemed that the frontier of the West had been pushed forward at least 1,200 miles towards the East. But it was a temporary wave only, and from the 2nd century of our era, the East reclaimed all its old rights and orientalized the Greek conquest again. With the limes now fixed in Syria, at the edge of the desert of a certain geographical boundary, always the same, thus tended to reappear. But with the Arabs, it was the East which now spilled over into Europe, in the Mediterranean as far as the Atlantic. The Arabs were more civilized than Europe, and it was they who possessed those qualities of initiative and that intellectual liberty which later on were to form the grandeur of the West. Finally, with the decline of the Ottoman Empire and its breakup, the old frontiers reappeared. Where are those frontiers? It would seem that the shores of the Mediterranean penetrated to some extent, though they are by Eastern influences, continue to belong to the West, by contrast to the continental hinterland. On the coasts, the commercial ports of the Levant belong to the West, as distinct from those of the interior, which are real ports of the desert, and have often been called bazaars. Whilst Alexandria, Beirut, and Tripoli are Mediterranean, Cairo, Jerusalem, Damascus, and Aleppo live in another climate and depend on another world. There is a contrast here between two geographical zones, between two civilizations, and it is not for nothing that the Mediterranean is sometimes referred to as the anti-desert. We must recognize, too, that the East begins with Islam, which has recaptured everything conquered by Greece and Rome in Asia. The life of the desert and its great spaces have, in short, not been westernized. They belong to the East, and that is why they have returned to it. Between continental Europe and Asia, the line of demarcation is less clear. Properly speaking, the West consists of Western and Central Europe, after which, towards the East, there is a gradual falling away. The time belts divide Europe very accurately into zones of civilizations. When the traveller across Europe reaches the Russian time belt, he is perhaps not yet in Asia, but he is no longer altogether in Europe, and he has certainly left the West behind him. And finally, in the extreme West, there is part of our civilization which is no longer European. The United States, the dominions of Great Britain, and the countries of Central and South America, at least to the extent to which the white race is dominant in them. On the periphery, too, we must add those white colonies rather than their settlements, which are administered by whites, and which thus represent something like a march. But we must leave out of account those countries which, although they have accepted our technique and even the outward appearance of our material civilization, nevertheless continue to owe their spiritual allegiance elsewhere. From this point of view, Egypt, Pakistan, and Hindustan do not fully belong to our family. And it is in this respect that the unity, fundamentally Christian, of the Western world appears, a unity which is perhaps its strongest bond of all, that humanism, that sense of pity and of charity, which in the words of St. Paul, covers a multitude of sins. In the light of these distinctions, and once we have cleared away a whole undergrowth of pretensions, outward appearances and hypocrisy, the true spirit of Western civilization is seen with reasonable clarity. Fundamentally, the West believes and proclaims that man can and should be the master of his own destiny. Western man does not wait passively for heaven to bring him to happiness. He takes a hand himself, and having determined the aims to be followed and the means to be employed to achieve them, his attitude is the negation of fatalism and passivity. The accent is placed on the material and social aspect of things, and it is less a matter of mysticism than of human progress. Those who know Asia know to what degree the atmosphere there is different, to what degree Asiatics, even today, rein themselves to misery, hunger, sickness, and physical decay. Certain quarters of Canton or Benares are reminiscent of some court of miracles. Obviously, Asiatics place the real source of happiness elsewhere than in material progress. Western man speaks of God, even thinks of him a great deal, but he often acts as though he did not reckon with his assistance. The proverb, "God helps those who help themselves," is illuminating. Hercules likes people to help themselves, and then he helps them, writes La Fontaine in his fable, The Cart Stuck in the Mud. Man must look to his own affairs as though there were no likelihood of heavenly intervention. It is the problem of action from the lay standpoint, and it leads to the definition of a sphere, a civil sphere, so to speak, in which reason and the methods of reason hold inclusive sway. In fact, we apply the principle thoroughly in dividing the world between God and Caesar, and the latter controls a world which belongs entirely to him, more so than we would like to think. Commenting on the famous words of Christ on the point, Renan declares that they are at the basis of Western civilization. Render, therefore, unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's. Profound exhortation, which decided the future of Christianity. Words of perfect spirituality and marvelous justice, which initiated the separation of the spiritual and the temporal, and laid the basis for true liberalism and true civilization. Siegfried, obviously a liberal, by the way, quite excited here, lots of exclamation marks in the text. This distinction between civil and religious life is also one which is foreign to the East. No dividing line there exists between the two spheres. And in Islam, even the notion of civil law appears inconceivable. The result is that a whole series of acts, including the most important in man's existence, are determined there by arguments which derive from faith, prophecy, and magic, and not from man's experience and man's reason. On the other hand, the West has no qualms about treating practical questions by practical considerations, and all suggestions to the contrary are rejected. I fear that perhaps in this respect, the West goes even further. It acts without the gods, we said, but if need be, it acts against them. Prometheus was a rebel who raised the opposition of mankind against the obedience demanded by the gods, and it was on account of his revolt, and not because it was the will of Zeus, that man's condition was improved. Europe, which upholds the tradition of the demigod day by day, essentially expresses that nonconformism which maintains its vitality. A movement makes the spring tides. One might well ask whether the adoption of a conformist attitude in the form of state totalitarianism, for example, would not be fatal to the real destiny of our continent. The critical spirit and the fighting spirit are congenital to it. The battle to defend the frontiers, where political unities refuse to mingle, the battle to decide who shall wield the hegemony and control the development of the world. All European history has been a succession of wars, which were properly speaking intestine, wars between rival states, none of which were strong enough to dominate the others. However, up to the present, the unity of European civilization has never been compromised. It is even a distinctive characteristic that political disunity has always gone hand in hand with a common culture. There is a parallel existence of creative spirit, a spirit of positive organization, and a critical spirit ready to turn itself into the spirit of revolt, a spirit which weighs, measures, discusses, and, at need, denies. Would Europe as preserved her vitality without this contradiction? But the fact remains that it is precisely this contradiction which now endangers her. This nonconformism crossed the Atlantic in the beginning, but it does not look as though it will survive there. The immediate result is impressive, but does it not represent one of the living sources which the extreme West is now in danger of losing? I have often said that a complete Western education should be crowned by a pilgrimage to those places of significance for the soul of man, to quote Barres, where our civilization was formed. I would go to the Caucasus to look for the rock of Prometheus, and then to the legendary site somewhere in Greece, where Hercules, who was anxious that we should help ourselves, accomplished his labours, supposing that the Aegean stables could not be met with a nearer home. And the Acropolis would be the centre of my pilgrimage. In that fatherland of the intellect, each of us would repeat the prayer of Renan. But a prayer of a different inspiration would be said in Jerusalem. Would it be paradoxical to suggest that we should search more for more than Jesus Christ there? Would that his presence is anything but essential, but should we associate with him with one place, who wanted no other limits for the religion of the spirit but those of humanity itself? It is before the rock of Abraham that I should refer in thought to the first conception of a personal God, the God who is still our God, concluding alliance with those who have a faith in him. But I do not think that I should want to leave out Alexandria. But then it would be to Rome, and I would turn my steps to meditate in the unique city which, whether in its imperial or its Catholic form, implanted the fundamental idea of order in our civilization. And passionate pilgrim that I am, I should afterwards want to go to the various places where the methods of science and modern technique were developed by the genius of a few men, except that the choice would be almost impossible. Should I seek in some corner of Germany for the room in which Descartes, in the quiet of his winter quarters, conceived the rules of thought which we practice even today? Or should I visit that faraway orchard of Lincolnshire to locate the apple tree from which Newton saw the apple drop? Should I track down Watt or Denis Papin, the inventors of the steam engine, the incisive instrument of the Industrial Revolution, or Claude Bernard in his humble laboratory in the Collège de France, where the experimental method was perfected in his hands, or Louis Pasteur to that garret in the Rue de Homme, where he was the first to catch a glimpse into the immensity of a new world? No, the work of man becomes too collective and above all too enormous for any one spot to provoke the exhilarating reflections to which it gives rise. I should prefer then to change my sphere and to move into that of adventure, to make the voyage of Ulysses all over again with Victor Bernard, to reconstitute a resounding raid of the Scandinavian Leif Erikson, who discovered America in the 11th century, but whose achievement does not count today because it lacked publicity. What a lesson! And then I should like above all to visit the southwestern coasts of Europe, open to immensity and to dreams, from which the Renaissance explorers set off for unknown worlds. The Church of Belém in Lisbon, where Vasco da Gama rests in the same spot which he set out to conquer the Indies, or the convent of Santa Maria la Rábida near Huelva, where we can hear the soughing of the ocean but not see it, the place where Columbus slept the night before his departure for the New World. What a magnificent Cook's tour! What an incomparable pilgrimage! Siegfried, very carried away in this section of the book. I do not know whether the West is innately superior to the East. If it is a question of the moral standpoint and the spiritual life, then I am not convinced it is so. But in the sphere of efficiency, there is no doubt that the West holds the palm. The reasons for this extraordinary predominance must be analysed. It is in the sphere of technique that our superiority is immediately evident, and in which it essentially resides. The advantage was not in our favour until approximately the 17th century. The Arabs, the Hindus, and the Chinese had all developed artisanship to a high level, to a level which, on our own admission, was considerably higher than our own. The fabrics of India and the porcelain and the lacquers of China were of a refinement which we can even now not equal, much less excel. Many of the inventions which we subsequently developed came in the first place from the East, which showed no interest in sharing their benefits. We used explosive powder for our guns. The Chinese used it long before for their fireworks. In the technique of artisanship, which marked the development of the Tool Age, the West thus did not occupy first place. It was the introduction of the machine which marked the beginning of a blossoming without parallel in our favour. In this respect, we even now enjoy a certain monopoly. The production of complicated mechanical products is still confined to the West. You can tell he was writing this in 1952, right? Elsewhere, they succeed in producing only a relatively simple industrial products. Even Japan, despite her admitted mastery of certain industrial specialities, has not yet shown herself capable of producing everything. But Asia has certainly learned to work with our machines. She uses them with dexterity and with great imitative skill. And above all, she uses them cheaply because her labour power costs her next to nothing. The cost price of Japanese or Chinese cotton goods defies Western competition. Hence the illusion frequently harboured by the Orientals. We now have your machines, and we know how to use them. Thus, we are now your equals. The superiority you once had over us no longer exists. Interesting words to think about in 2025. Anyway, let's continue. It is quite true that the motor car, even the aeroplane, and the machine in general is no longer the monopoly of one continent, but the deep-rooted cause of the success of the West does not lie in the everyday use of such machines. It lies in the fact that all modern mechanical inventions, and in general all industrial inventions, come from the countries of the white race. At a certain moment of their development, all human civilizations have sown ingenuity in their turn. There has been no monopoly in this respect by any one continent or any one race. Nevertheless, it may justly be said that in the present period of industrialism, the West has done everything and the East has done nothing. It is all very well to work a machine, but it is not enough. One must be able to repair it if it breaks down, to improve it, to make it anew, and conceive it all over again to meet the need of new circumstances and new demands. Asia copies, and she copies extremely well, but she does not renew the ideas that she borrows. A blockade of skill and proficiency which separated her from the European or American source of modern inventions would soon find her impotent, or at least lagging far behind. Whilst the West continued to make progress, Asia would probably remain in a state of relative stagnation, not for lack of intelligence and energy, but for lack of inspiration and creative method, perhaps also a lack of belief in material progress. However, I do not think that we have as yet touched on the more direct reason for Western success in the great modern achievements and developments. In my view, one must look for this reason in the ability of the West to administer. Material production falls historically into certain great phases of development, but they are so entangled in their order of succession that we still find them side by side in some countries, even today, sometimes almost in the same factories. Corresponding to the tool age, there was first of all the artisan or artistic phase, closely bound up with the use of the tool. With the advent of the machine came the mechanical phase, which in its turn gave rise to a tremendous development of modern history industry. But in expanding to large-scale serial manufacture, it tends to push production forward into a new phase, a phase that might be termed administrative or managerial, because the new form of administration of large-scale undertakings requires an organization so complex that it extends beyond the technical sphere proper. In all the big industrial countries, recent censuses have underlined the same significant fact, namely, that the numerical proportion of operative personnel is diminishing in relation to the administrative and commercial personnel, which is growing more rapidly. The role of manufacture properly, so-called, in the cost of production is diminishing, whilst that of administration is proportionally increasing. The administrators and the organizers are becoming more and more the leaders of industry in place of the technicians. Now, at present, the West alone possesses this genius, for administering things on the grand scale. We know the qualities which are required for the successful administration of modern large-scale undertaking. The men in charge must be able to decide the aims of being pursued and to adapt the methods at their disposal to them. They must be able to calculate accurately the time necessary for production, because time plays an inexorable role in determining the costs of production. They must also be able to foresee the wear and tear to which the equipment will be subjected, so that arrangements can be made to maintain it and to replace it by amortization. When an undertaking is big and its personnel numerous, a singularly intelligent direction is necessary to maintain both discipline and efficiency of the collective effort. Experience has shown that the West has, in fact, all the qualities necessary for this purpose, but they still remain almost entirely foreign to the East. To go to the crux of the problem, we find that the real head of an undertaking must have a certain sense of management, and that seems up to the present to have remained a monopoly of the West. The Westerner sets himself an aim, and he is determined to attain it within a certain length of time. He knows how to subordinate his personal convenience and even his personal feelings to the achievements of his aim. And as he also has a sense of time, he does not allow himself to dawdle. He can estimate accurately the value and efficiency of the forces at his disposal. He knows in particular that unless his equipment is kept in repair, it will deteriorate rapidly. Now, this process of maintenance demands care and foresight, and that is something which belongs essentially to the Westerner, so much so that I am half inclined to give that it is here that we must look for his distinctive characteristic. No Asiatic is capable of taking proper care of a machine. Every Asiatic house is neglected, and its owner never seems to suffer much distress in consequence, not even if otherwise his tastes are refined. Entrusted building a business or large-scale public works to an Asiatic, and then return at the end of the year or after 10 years, and you will see at once the difference between his management at the time when a European was in charge. Individuality and personal responsibility, these qualities are lacking in the East. In Asia, a man is not used to doing anything on his own responsibility. He always works as part of a group. The group dominates him, and he feels himself at one with it. The effort is collective in the same sense as in Europe, but individuality is divided. It is a family affair. The prevailing morale is one of obedience, either to parents or to social castes. It may be that they work harder and longer in the East than we do in Europe, that they are more frugal, and that their physical labours of endurance are greater. It may be, too, that ingenuity comes to the help of organisation. A motor car entrusted to a Chinese mechanic is unusable in 6 months, and yet he manages to use it somehow for perhaps another 5 years after that. Family industry of the Chinese type operates with costs of production with which not even our most advanced technique can compete, but with an Asiatic one always has the impression that he is more interested in speculation than in organization. Dexterity attracts him more than routine, and he regards life as hardly much more than a succession of particular cases which good fortune, ingenuity, or cunning will allow him to turn to his own advantage. If you go to the East, you will find industries, undertakings, and administrations which are outwardly much like our own. But before long, you will discover that the best Asiatic is not so good as the poorest Westerner from the standpoint of efficiency. They are not in the same class at all. The European, who at home would appear to you very ordinary and without culture, is the man to whom in the East you would entrust the management of an undertaking in preference of much more brilliant than the natives. He will do the job somehow or other, whilst the others would probably ruin it. Big international undertakings, shipping companies, transcontinental canals, public health authorities and so on, have remained up to now in the hands of Westerners. If they should ever be taken over by Asiatics, it is not at all certain that civilization as a whole would not suffer in consequence. Where do Westerners get their exceptional capacities? From their technique, we have said, organized in practical, productive collectives and founded on proved scientific methods. But we must go still further back than that, to the sources themselves, which lie deeper, because these scientific methods themselves are only one aspect of our way of reasoning altogether. Perhaps we do not sufficiently take into account how much our efficiency we owe to Greek reasoning developed by Bacon, Descartes, Claude Bernard, and others, which consists essentially in dealing with problems in themselves and ruthlessly eliminating everything which does not depend on reason. On the other hand, the Asiatic, and still even more the African, constantly introduces arguments of an extra-rational character, which then play a role in the making of his decisions. In China, for example, the furrows traced by the plough in the field are deliberately made crooked, and the object of this is to prevent evil spirits from following them and spoiling the harvest, because as every Chinese knows, evil spirits can move only in a straight line. For the same reason, the Chinese consults a necromancer before he decides where his house or his factory shall be sited. Of course, the West is not entirely free from such superstitions, and they are still to be met with here and there in the countryside, but they have been almost completely eliminated in urban and industrial areas. Our dualism, based on the separation of the rational and the irrational, ensures the independence of both the civil and the religious spheres to such an extent that Renan could regard it with justice as the basis of true liberalism and true civilization. The liberation has made Western thought into an incomparable instrument of action. It is from this standpoint that Piaget interprets the efficiency of the method perfected by Descartes. What I claim is that his method is also a morale of thought, or a morale of thought, or if you like, everything is moral with him, because everything is conduct and the will of conduct. And perhaps his greatest innovation and his greatest stroke of genius is to have conducted his thought deliberately as though it were an action. If that is so, the Westerner is a man who conducts his thought as though it were action, and whose action is determined by the rules of conscious thought capable of controlling itself. With this, we go back to the original source, critical liberty. But this depends in its turn on political liberty. And here we meet the ancient claim of the Greeks. We are free men. It is no exaggeration to believe that if political liberty were to disappear in Europe, its very vitality would be undermined. Directed at controlled economics, extended to the sphere of thought, would dry up an essential stream. Any totalitarian regime would be fatal to our destiny. In his infamous speech in 1846 in favour of the abolition of the Corn Laws, the English statesman Sir Robert Peel made great play with the advantages enjoyed by the country thanks to its coal resources, its industrial equipment, and its unparalleled economic efficiency. But amongst the arguments which he esteems most cogent, he put first the regime of liberty and the tradition of free discussion which the country enjoyed. Are we a country which must fear competition? He demanded in conclusion. The same is true of the West today. So long as it preserves and perseveres, its liberty, its superiority will remain incontestable. And he goes on. There's still quite a bit of left. Three whole pages left, friends. The threats which might compromise the future of Western civilization do not come from without, but from within. One cause of decline can be seen in the unsettled state of the principles which guide it, and in fact that the peoples who are now taking the leadership into their hands are more and more remote from the traditional European axis. We have described the source of Western civilization as a triple conception of knowledge, the individual and technique, but a certain balance amongst these factors is also necessary, and technique must be in the service of the individual, and not the individual in the service of power, which derives from technique. We were civilized long before the Industrial Revolution made its contribution to civilization, but shall we remain civilized in the old sense in which we have always understood it, if mechanical efficiency becomes more important than all our other preoccupations? Our chronic materialism, which is indifferently kept in bounds by the exhortations of the Bible, is increasing under the democratic regime of the masses, and it is losing contact with the aesthetic tradition which was the progenitor of energy and moral strength. The spirit of initiative is in danger of being lost in the abuses of state direction and control, which favour and even impose conformism. That is a disposition which is contrary to the true genius of our civilization. Such possibilities do not exist merely in a pessimistic imagination. We can see them approaching more than virtually under our eyes today. There is too much government intervention, too much regimentation, too much organization in manufacture. We are removing ourselves too much, too far from nature. There is too much urbanism. There is too much artificiality to our social life. And the danger in all these directions comes rather from excess than from too little, because the West is, after all, only exaggerating its system, pushing it to the point of absurdity. Such are the defects of the administrative age, which has been revealed up to the present. The pathological excess of organization contains within itself only too evidently the germs of paralysis. Up to now, Europe has been the home of Western culture, squeezed between two giants, the United States and Russia. Europe has no doubt retained intellectual and creative vitality, but the ability to apply it is now lacking. Is there not some danger that in the hands of our leaders, one of which is not a European and the other not authentically Western, our civilization is in danger of changing its character? America is now the supreme guarantor of Western civilization, to which she belongs just as we do. She represents the democratic and the Christian tradition, expressing itself in respect for the individual, for liberty, for enterprise, with the same right as we do. At the same time, we cannot fail to recognize that the American people live in a geographical environment whose structure does not in the least resemble that in which Europe was formed. Can our philosophy of moderation therefore hope to survive? We know the prestige attached to quantity and records in America. Everything there tends towards the mass in surroundings which are, to some extent, homogeneous and which lend themselves fully to all the demands of standardization. In the long run, the very climate itself might well have the effect of modifying the white race transplanted by immigration to these new territories, and in a way which might well make the not too much of our forefathers out of fashion. Other changes are to be anticipated, owing to the break with the traditions which Europe inherited from its remote Mediterranean past. The emigrants who crossed the Atlantic were European, many of them Mediterranean, but their assimilation there has ruthlessly cut them off from their ancestral roots. The Christian influence has remained strong, but it has also been hard-pressed by the religion of success. And in this respect, the dynamism, which derives from biblical origins, survives there as much as, if not more than, in Europe. But the classic tradition has not passed fully to the New World, where it is combined to universities and books, and not as a living principle. The critical spirit is in danger of declining with it. Conformism has become a common and a general attitude in the United States. And it corresponds to the instinctive tendencies of a regime which is founded more and more on organization. The sphere of choice, preference, and initiative is narrowing in favor of a system which no longer grants the individual the place and importance he once enjoyed. There are no longer the conditions in which Europe developed, nonconformist, divided, rebellious, but our mother. Something new is in the process of being born. It will still be Western, but it will no longer be our West. At the other extreme of the Western world, the Soviet Union displays the same factors of mass which cause us such misgivings. Its geographic, demographic, and economic structure is not proportioned to Europe at all, and it is impossible that a fact of such significance should remain without consequence. Russia's solutions resemble America's more than ours do, because in Russia, just as in America, the mass is in the ascendant. The mysticism of the Russian peoples, which penetrates even the demonstrative materialism of its official doctrine, is not of Western origin. This combination of technique and social mysticism is directed against culture, henceforth a reactionary notion, and directly contradicts the ancient Greece and Christian conception of the individual as an independent spiritual being. The victory of communism would mean the end of the West, and moreover, Moscow makes no secret of its desire for this consummation. Let us not forget that Europe has only just escaped from a peril which would have compromised its spiritual integrity and personality. Unified under German domination, Europe would have seen those forces which, dispersed independently, represented her weakness, but at the same time maintained her fruitful though dangerous diversity, drawn together in one aggressive whole. As Macedonia led the whole of Greece in a war of revenge and conquest against Asia, so Hitler's military leadership would have tremendously increased the power of Europe and probably made it master of the entire world. But in this adventure, Hellenism lost its purity and Europe would have lost its soul. Today, there are other influences which are tending to change Western civilization. We have sought to show the part that can be played in that transformation by the Latins, by the French, the English, the Germans, the Russians, and the Americans. Whatever may befall, a new chapter is now opening up in the history of the world. Perhaps we should even speak of a new book altogether. All right, well, thank you very much, Andre Siegfried. He was a liberal to the last, quite a kind of Whiggish version, I guess, a French. Is there such a thing as a French Whig, kind of French liberal reading of Western civilization and history? But still, a lot of interesting points raised, I think, in that chapter and indeed in the entire book. Let me know if you've enjoyed this. If people really want it, I could put maybe the entire book in one long 6-hour video or something. You know, if people will really want that, I could probably make that happen. Whether my computer processor could handle processing such a large file remains to be seen. I can handle it, I reckon. Is that Western magic or is it Eastern magic? I don't know, because I'm not sure who made my computer. Intel, an American company, made my computer, but I think it was probably processed over in China. Anyway, thank you very much, folks. I'll be back again tomorrow morning, where I'll be looking at some aspect of the British news, the Indian trade deal, and for office hours. I'll see you then. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends,